The retirement and IRA show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Solnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Solnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition for this week. This week, we're going to get back to normal, I guess you could say, where we start off the show with one or two Social Security questions. So we've had kind of a shallow pool of Social Security questions since Jim misplaced the pile we had, but sounds like listeners have come to our rescue and sent him some new questions on the topic of Social Security. So I haven't seen them yet, so it'll be a surprise for all of us, but Jim promises me he's got a couple Social Security questions.
I do, but I also don't like the way you worded it, that I misplaced the Social Security questions. I thought we decided last week we solved this mystery. Not the mice. You, on your way to the bathroom, took them.
Oh, into the bathroom.
No, I hope you didn't take them into the bathroom. Because then if I do find them, I'm not going to want to touch them. Remember the Seinfeld where George took a book into the bathroom and then he couldn't return it?
I don't remember that one.
Yeah, he was in a bookstore. And you know how in bookstores, well, especially in the 90s before Amazon took off, you would go to the bookstore, you could actually sit there and read, and they served coffee and all this.
Yeah.
Well, he actually carried one of the books into the bathroom, and then the manager caught him and wouldn't let him return it. And the book got flagged, and no matter where he went, everybody knew. I don't know how. They never tell you how it got flagged. Everyone knew that it was in the bathroom, and no one would take it back.
I miss that
There's
one.
There's a Seinfeld for everything.
I know. You should know that.
I've
seen almost all of them, but apparently not every single one.
Yeah,
so
that was one. Yeah. But I thought, folks, we had solved the mystery of the missing Social Security questions. We do have the empty paperclip still on my desk. I'm still not convinced it wasn't Chris trying to be sly and read them because he knows I don't review questions with him ahead of time. So he picked them up, for some reason decided to remove the paperclip and put the paperclip back down, left with the questions, and somehow lost them. Because it certainly wasn't me who lost them.
Slim chance of that.
I'm not going to swear to it.
My
hypothesis may be true. You know, I almost became a detective when I was a cop.
Some strange person might have broken into the building and taken them as well.
They
could have.
I analyzed that option, but the alarm would have went off. So I ruled that one out quickly. But you slithering around up here, since I'm right out in front of the bathroom now, on a card table, and you see all the questions that I leave out, I think you took them.
Hmm.
There's no proof, but the detective in me, or the almost detective in me.
Maybe there's a reason you were almost a detective.
I didn't stay on the police department long enough to get appointed.
Mm-hmm. They saw your powers of deductive reasoning. They anticipated this whole story about these missing Social Security questions and realized that would probably not be the right way to apply the law.
I can't think of any other reasonable explanation of how those Social Security questions disappeared.
They're in your car, probably.
You don't have to whisper. Everyone can hear you. No, I checked my car. And they're not in my car.
Okay.
But anyways, I do not think I lost them, but listeners to the rescue, thank you. We kind of got into the habit of leading with one or two Social Security questions, and we got some in this week. So
excellent.
I'm going to jump them to the top of the pile and fire them away at you. I think you can answer both of these, although one of them totally confused me, and I wasn't quite sure what they were saying. We got three questions on Social Security in. I need you, even though I don't generally give you the questions ahead of time, one of them, I don't understand what he's asking. So I don't want to read it only for you to say, huh? So I just want to make sure you at least understand okay. what he's saying, because I have no clue what he's saying.
Okay.
All right. So we're going to answer two Social Security questions, one from a Pennsylvanian and one from a Californian. Mm-hmm. And anyways, I will lead with the Pennsylvanian. Is that Pennsylvanian? That's what they're called, right? Yeah.
Sure.
Okay. He gives his full name, but again, we're going to protect his anonymity, and we're going to call him George. It begins, "Hi, Jim and Chris. My name is," and he almost got me because his real name is there, but we're going to call him George. "Hi, Jim and Chris. My name is George from Pennsylvania. I am 54 years old. I was married for 22 years, but I am now divorced. Your podcast is excellent, and it has inspired me to think about my Social Security claiming strategies and how much I will receive by opening my Social Security account online. When I did that, I found I will receive about $2,000 a month at my full retirement age. My ex-wife is 2 years younger than me, but makes double what I make. So here is my question. Could I file for my Social Security at my full retirement age? Then if my ex-wife passes away, switch to a survivor benefit, which would most likely be higher since she earns more than I do. If so, what if she were to pass before my full retirement age? Could I take a spousal benefit under her if I'm at least 60 and let mine grow to 70? Chris, please do not let Jim misplace this. No, listener.
Mm-hmm.
You got it wrong.
He nailed it right there.
It should be, Jim, please do not let Chris steal this email as well on the way to the bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
And then he ends it with "Go Steelers," all in caps.
Mm.
Yeah, so we got a Steeler fan here, which is okay, And they did well this week. Who did they play? They played the Broncos this week.
And they played half the Broncos.
Well, the Broncos started with a full team. They just didn't end
dropping like
with
flies.
A full team. My goodness, no kidding. You guys are losing players left, right, and then left again.
This has suddenly become a rebuilding year even more than it was. But anyway, he's on the right track, so a couple clarification rules here. Yes, once you're married at least 10 years, you receive treatment as if you were still married essentially, with some slight modifications to the rules, which means that you do qualify for a spousal benefit while your ex-spouse is alive and would qualify for a survivor benefit if your ex-spouse were to pass away. In this case, she would qualify against his record as well. Having been married, you know, if he was married 22 to her, then obviously she was married 22 to him. Like that deductive reasoning there?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I could be a detective. But anyway, she makes almost double what he does. However, her benefit isn't going to be double under the current rules, just because there are limitations on what the benefits might be. Could very well be larger than the $2,000 by a fair amount, but it's not like her benefit's going to be $4,000 in today's terms. Here we're talking in 2020. But she very well might have a larger benefit if she's had a full career, doesn't have any huge gaps in her earnings history, if she's basically made twice as much. So she's the higher earner in this case. And he asked a couple questions. First, if he claims at full retirement age, he didn't ask this, but I know some of you are wondering, would he qualify for a spousal benefit? Well, he would qualify if the spousal benefit was bigger than half of, if the spousal benefit itself, which is half of hers, would be bigger than his own. In this case, it's basically impossible for that to happen. The spousal benefit would have to be based on a $4,000 a month benefit or bigger, and there isn't a benefit quite that big yet for people at their full retirement age. So the spousal benefit isn't going to be an option for him with the current rules and the current numbers that we've got. So he could claim his own. No help on the spousal while she's still alive. But if she were to predecease him, then he does qualify for a survivor benefit. That's assuming he doesn't get remarried to someone else before the age of 60. As long as he waits till after 60, he retains the ability to claim a survivor benefit on his ex-spouse's record. And so it is possible in his first scenario, claim his own, and then later on, if she dies first, he would then get the higher benefit that she's earned because of her higher earnings record. And so, yes, is the simple answer to his first question. He could do that. His second question was, what would happen if she were to die prior to his full retirement age? Could he claim a spousal benefit? What he really meant was a survivor benefit. If she's passed away, the survivor benefit is what's available. And yes, he would be able to claim a survivor benefit as young as age 60. Could be as young as age 50 if he's disabled, but he didn't mention that. So we'll assume 60 is the first age that he'd be eligible to do that. So between his age 60 and his age 67, if she were to pass away, he could immediately file for a survivor benefit, leaving his own benefit untouched, growing in the background. And if it was going to end up being larger, he would take that strategy. He could also do the reverse strategy, which is to claim his own first at a reduced rate since he's claiming it before his full retirement age, and then later on switch to the survivor benefit. You'd have to see the exact numbers. I can't give him further guidance on which of those techniques would be best without knowing her benefit and us running some hypothetical ages through, you know, through our brains or software, one or the other. This one isn't super complicated, but without knowing what her benefit is, I couldn't tell you which strategy would be best. But it is possible to deploy either strategy under the current rules. Either claim the survivor first and then switch to his later, or claim his first and switch to the survivor later, if she were to, in his hypothetical, pass away prior to his full retirement age. So yes, he has, being married 22 years, still has the rights to claim either a spousal benefit or a survivor benefit, depending on whether she's alive or passed, on her record, as long as he does not remarry. Remarriage will eliminate the spousal opportunity. The survivor benefit, there's a special rule. If the remarriage happens after his age 60, then he retains the survivor benefit capability on her record. So there's, like I said, there's a couple of nuanced differences between ex-spousal benefits and current spousal benefits. But for the most part, they treat people, once they've been married for 10 years, even after being divorced, they treat them, for the most part, like currently married spouses. So I think I checked all the boxes. I took notes as you were reading that. I think those were all the questions that he answered. Did I fulfill his request there, Jim?
I think you did.
Perfect.
Perfect. On to the next one, which is a very long email. I'm going to try to truncate it. Some people go on and on and on and on and on.
So you wrote this email to yourself?
I did not. That was a little bit of self-deprecating humor there. Okay, this is a Californian, as we've already said. We're going to call her Georgette. She put that in parentheses next to her real name. Mm-hmm. And it begins, I'm going to try again. Let me see. I'm going to skip her introductory paragraph where she said some very nice things about us. So I do thank you, listener, for that. But I'm going to get into the nitty-gritty. I have a question about Social Security timing, and I can't find the answer to it on the Social Security website or in Google. So this is a game now, folks. Who is smarter, Google or Chris? Hey, isn't there?
You're making me nervous now.
There's that show with that app there that tells you what you're listening to. You ever see that? Who's smarter? You got to guess a song before the app. Shazam. Remember Shazam?
Oh, right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So maybe we should start a game show called Google, where you have to be smarter than Google when it comes to Social Security. All righty. I'm getting... You ready for the question?
I'm ready.
All right. You got a pen?
Yes.
All right. You might want to write some of this down.
Okay.
I'm getting survivor's benefits after my husband's death in 2017. I want to switch to my own benefits when I turn 70, which will be in June of 2023. Chris has explained in the past that Social Security Administration doesn't give benefit increases in a monthly stepwise fashion, as I would have expected. I'm going to pause there. I believe, Chris, she's talking about delayed retirement credits because she's waiting to age 70.
That's got to be it, because they do calculate the delayed retirement credit benefit itself. The increase in your benefit is calculated on a monthly basis. So you don't have to wait a whole year to get the 8% increase. They give you 0.8% every single month that you delay. Now, what she has to be referring to is that when they apply those credits, when they give you those credits, can be a little disjointed, because they set your benefit for the year in January every year. They set it before that, so the January benefit is correct. So if you claimed mid-year, you might not get all the delayed retirement credits initially. It might take till the next calendar year is the easiest way to describe it. So that's got to be what she's talking about, because it is true that they do apply monthly delayed retirement credits. It's just a matter of when they start showing up in the deposits that's the question. And that's probably what she's talking about.
Okay.
But good news for her is if she waits till 70, doesn't have to worry about it because they apply them immediately.
Okay.
So I might be anticipating one of her questions, but...
Well, she continues.
Mm-hmm.
Another listener asked you guys about benefit filing on his 67th and a half year time frame, if I remember correctly. And it got me to wondering, when I ask for my age 70 benefits, should I request it 3 months ahead of my birthday month, or will I be penalized by applying before I'm 70? I don't want to get a smaller survivor's benefit when I can get my own benefit. I would have thought this would be an easy question to answer, but after dealing with the Social Security Administration, who are unfailingly nice but not necessarily well-informed, I feel like Alice who went down a rabbit hole. Their math is not my math. Is there some way for me to figure it out on my own? I don't quite know what she... I think she's asking a few different things here.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, let's begin with her first question, Chris. She wants to delay to 70.
Mm-hmm.
Should she file 3 months before? If so, would they not give her those 3 months worth of delayed retirement credits? Or should she wait to 70 to file?
It's going to be how she asks them to start the benefit that's going to determine this. She can certainly go in or contact them 3 months ahead. You just want to make the claim where you're switched to your own benefit effective the month that you are 70. And you can make that request before that. What you don't want to do is let them start it 3 months early. You don't want them to switch you early, because that would then cost you permanently 3 months of delayed retirement credits, or a quarter of 8% or 2%. You would lose 2% benefit that you would have gotten by waiting those extra 3 months. So it's just a matter of being careful to watch the paperwork that they fill out, to make it very, very clear that you want this change to go into effect, this change from your survivor benefit you're currently collecting, it sounds like, over to your own benefit at the month that you're 70. And they will immediately then give you the full age 70 benefit. That is the one claiming age where they don't play this little game of giving you prorated delayed retirement credits in the first year and then topping you up in the next calendar year. When you're age 70 and claim your own, they give you all the delayed retirement credits immediately that month. I don't know why they go out of their way to do it on that month and not any other month, but they'll do it at age 70. Probably because I got sick of explaining why it would be funky the first year. So no, there's no problem with calling them or contact them 3 months early. It's actually a good idea. It's really tough on them when you want to make a change in the month you're contacting them. They can usually pull it off, but it's kind of messy. The change won't go through the system fully immediately, and then they'll have to send you a check or do some adjustments essentially after the fact. It's kind of messy. So it is better if you contact them early enough to have the computer all set to go. Always remember that they pay a month in arrears. So the first benefit check or deposit that you will get for this new benefit at your age 70 will be the month after that you turn age 70. All right. That first question she was asking. As far as, I don't think there's really much else that she's running into that is that much trouble, other than maybe determining what her age 70 benefit would be. She didn't share with me any numbers.
I think
I can't
that's
guide
what she meant,
because
she said their math is not my math. So I'm wondering if that's what she meant by that.
Yeah, and that could be. The only way I could verify that would be to see their math, to see what's going on. But if she were to contact them and ask specifically, what will be my benefit at my age 70, the month I am 70, if I claim at that point, they should give her a number, and the computer should be calculating it correctly. If she asks a simple, straightforward question like that, the printout should be accurate. The problem with looking it up online is once you're claiming, if you go onto your online the online portal at Social Security, it just shows what you're currently collecting. It's very frustrating, actually, for people who are collecting one benefit and anticipate switching to another benefit later. The visibility of that other benefit just disappears once you're claiming. You have to actually contact them. They haven't, to the best of my knowledge, opened up the ability for you to look in and say, oh, what would my benefit be if I switched to my own? It just completely disappears in the case that she is, where she's claimed the survivor benefit. You log on, it'll say, congratulations, you're collecting, and this is the amount you're getting. It's a survivor benefit. Your own earnings history and the benefit estimate for that earnings history is nowhere to be seen currently. So you do have to contact them.
Okay. And then I want to mention two things, or at least propose questions to you, Chris, that I think she was kind of asking, or at least was paying attention to, but I think if you expand upon them, listeners will find this of value. The first thing she mentioned, and I remember that email question, the gentleman who was going to claim, he wanted to claim at 67, but he also wanted the 6 months of, what do you call that, the 6 month retroactive benefits.
Mm-hmm.
So he was asking, should he wait to 67 and a half? So then when he gets his 6 months retro, they would recalculate him as if he retired at 67, which is what he wanted to do, as opposed to claiming at 67 and getting 6 months back, and then they would have made him retiring at 66 and a half. Why don't you explain retroactive benefits and what that listener was trying to do, and that it really doesn't apply in the case of this listener?
Right. So retroactive benefits are still available. The rules on that, you have to be your full retirement age. So there's no such thing as retroactive benefits for claiming prior to your full retirement age. They essentially have this rule that grants you some grace if you forget to pull the trigger on your benefit at full retirement age and regret it or come to realize, oh, darn, I should have turned it on 2 months ago or something. They'll let you file retroactively. They effectively backdate the application up to 6 months, but no further back than your full retirement age month. So a month after, if you miss it by a month, you can only file retroactively 1 month. You miss it by 3 months, you can retroactive that whole 3 months. But if you miss it by 4 years, you forget to file, and then you suddenly wake up, oh, I should have filed my Social Security a long time ago. Nope, you're limited to 6 months retroactive. And the way that works is they'll turn on the benefit. You'll receive benefits for the rest of your life as if you had claimed that 6 month prior date. So you'll get delayed retirement credits if they're applicable to that date, not the date you're filing, but the 6 month retroactive date. And you'll suddenly get a lump sum payment for those months that were missed, that you essentially, the system now thinks you filed 6 months ago, but they didn't pay you. So they're going to true you up or catch you up with a lump sum payment. And the way I've usually seen it is your monthly benefit will start first, And then about a month or two after that, suddenly you'll get this lump sum payment that processes it. It's just the slow progression of these lump sum fixes through the system will cause that. So in this particular case, she's not looking to file retroactively. When she goes in to file her own benefit, she's not wanting to backdate it. She's wanting to just turn it on at age 70 without any sort of delays or collecting of a lump sum. I don't remember all the details of the email that you reference about him claiming, but you could he could claim at 67 and not do it retroactively, or 67 and a half and do it retroactively. He'd end up in the same spot. He'll collect exactly the same amount of money. It's just a matter of, do I want to collect it every month, or do I want to wait 6 months and then have them send me a six-month lump sum payment instead? So if you know you're going to collect as of, you want it as of a certain date, there's no reason to wait past it and then do the retroactive. You're not gaining yourself anything. It's not like you've found a loophole in the application of a delayed retirement credits, thinking, oh, I'll delay to 67 and a half, I'll get the delayed retirement credits, but then I'll file retroactively, win-win. Well, no, it's a win-lose, right? You get the lump sum benefit, but they've backdated the effective date of your claiming. So if they backdate it 6 months, they undo 6 months worth of delayed retirement credits simultaneously. So it's not a loophole by any means. They've got that protection in place.
Okay, and then the other part that she referenced on there. Let me see if I can find it. I put the email down because I picked up the other emails that we were going to answer. So she asked about that one, the 67, and then the delayed retirement credits themselves. When she said that they're not paid in a monthly stepwise fashion, did you explain to listeners how delayed retirement credits are actually credited? You know, you got to wait to the end of the year and then they're credited the following.
Right. So the way they now, remember I said she had a get out of jail free card, because by claiming at 70, they apply all the credits all the way up to 70 immediately.
Right.
There's no issue. But if you
what
do
happens
it,
if you do it in between?
If you do it in between your full retirement age and age 70, they actually determine your benefit and award you the delayed retirement credits at the beginning of each year. And let's say that you wanted to file at 69, get the delayed retirement credits, and you turned 69 in July. Well, when you go in and file at 69, they're going to award you ultimately the delayed retirement credits all the way up to you turning 69. The problem is, in that first year that you're claiming, so from July to the end of the year, you're only going to be receiving delayed retirement credits up to as if you were 66 and a half, January of that year. It isn't until the following January that they look in the system and they say, oh, look, they delayed another 6 months into this year. We owe them another 6 months worth of delayed retirement credits. And suddenly in January, your benefit will go up about 4% because you're getting another half year's worth of delayed retirement credits at that point. That's the thing she's kind of alluding to in her question. It's that effect, and it's not well documented anywhere. You kind of have to understand the operations of Social Security, which I don't remember the first time I stumbled across this. It was probably reading some detailed, nerdy article about Social Security, but it's just one of those bizarre things in how they've got things programmed in the computer that essentially you miss out on a half year's worth of delayed retirement credits in my example, but only for half a year. In January, then they true it up, and now for the rest of your life, you're going to get delayed retirement credits that you deserved up to you claiming at age 69 in my particular example. But for whatever reason, in 70, if you turn 70 in May or July or October, midway through the year, they don't do this thing where they only grant you part of the delayed retirement credits and you have to wait till January of the next year to get all of them. They give you all of them immediately. Don't ask me why. It's just the way it works. So they could change it, I'm sure. And if they do, I'll let you know. But under current processes, my understanding is it still works that way.
Okay. All right. Couple of non-Social Security questions now. This one is it's very, very similar to one we answered last week. This one came in several months ago. So I'm going to not spend a lot of time on it, but it's again, basic mistakes that people, I won't say basic mistakes, just a misunderstanding, I think, of how some of these strategies may work. And it has to do with the mega backdoor Roth conversions, or mega backdoor Roths that you can do through your employer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it begins. Hi, Jim and Chris. Greetings from Southern Illinois. I have a couple of questions regarding a mega backdoor Roth conversion. I'm married, and I have a $130,000 salary. My goal is to put $40,000 a year into mine and my wife's Roth IRAs combined. Since our income is less than the direct Roth contribution limits, we can put $12,000 into our Roths that way.
Mm-hmm.
So far, out of the 40 he wants, Chris, I agree, mm-hmm. 12 is no problem. Six,
yep.
In
so
his.
He's under 50, so that's why the six is the limit.
Right. I'm guessing he's under 50. He doesn't give his age, but because he did six and six, I agree with
he's
you.
He's either under 50 or he doesn't realize he can do seven if he's 50 and over. So.
Correct. If he's over 50, listener, you can get $14,000 in. But so right. far, no problem.
Right.
So out of the 40 he wants, he can easily get 12 in, leaving 28,000. Mm-hmm. And he says, 28,000 left to go. Okay. Then he goes on. My 401k plan offers a traditional option, a Roth option, and the ability to make after-tax contributions. It also allows for in-service distributions.
Hmm. He's got a very flexible plan so far.
So my plan is to contribute $19,500 to my Roth 401k. So let me pause there, listeners. So far, he's on board. What he's allowed to do is you can contribute up to $19,500 as an employee elective deferral, and that's what he's doing. He's going to elect to defer.
Under the age of 50.
Correct. And he is going to direct that into the Roth part of his 401k. So it's the equivalent, if you will, listeners, of him putting an additional $19,500 into his Roth IRA, except it's going into a Roth 401k.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So he, so far, he's catching up. He's got $8,500 to go. Follow that so far?
So far.
Okay. Plus, I will now make $8,500 of after-tax contributions. Now, I do want to make sure, listener, because you write, it also allows for in-service distributions. My plan is to contribute $19,500 to my Roth 401k plus $8,500 of after-tax contributions. That $8,500, listener and listeners, cannot go into the Roth 401k pot. Your elective or after-tax optional contributions that his 401k allows cannot go into a Roth 401k. They must go into the traditional 401k. Just want to point that part out.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what he meant, but I wasn't 100% sure.
Yeah. I don't think he, from what you read so far, I didn't hear him say, into my Roth. He just said he's going to make this additional after-tax.
But it was all in the same sentence,
yeah.
So mm-hmm. I didn't know if he separated the two or not.
Good thing to clarify
that's
that.
That's all yep. I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now he's going to outline the steps that he thinks he's going to follow.
Okay.
Step one, roll over any and all of my Roth 401k dollars into my IRA with no implication, no tax implications at all. Let me pause there. I'm assuming, listener, you're talking about your Roth IRA, but you said my IRA. Do not, you cannot move a Roth 401k into a traditional IRA, and you wouldn't want to do it that way.
Right.
So I'm assuming he's talking about moving it into his Roth IRA.
Mm-hmm.
So far, so good, but it's probably not going to work the way he thinks. What's going to happen, listener, is you might... Well, let me continue. Let me get back into some more, and then we'll get into what I want to explain. Okay. I can also, and then he puts in quotation marks, mega backdoor Roth convert my $8,500 of after-tax contributions as well. With this, quote, mega backdoor, I think I can include or exclude the earnings on that money. If I include the earnings, I know I will have to pay taxes on it. Mm-hmm. If I exclude the earnings, I won't have to pay taxes on it.
Yep.
I assume when I do this, nothing has to be withheld from my conversions for taxes. I will get a 1099-R. He actually put a 100-R. It's 1099-R, not a 100-R. I will get a 1099-R from my company at the end of the year to report any earnings that I may owe taxes on. This seems pretty simple to me. But all the websites I go to explaining mega backdoor Roth conversions stress how complicated they are and that it shouldn't be done without consulting a tax specialist. Am I missing something here? Is there a more optimal way for me to get the money that I want into my Roth IRAs? Okay. A couple of things, listener. Mega backdoor are complicated because a lot is going to have to do with how the employer accounts for your contributions. And that's one crucial element you didn't share with us. Please remember the cream and the coffee rule, cream in the coffee rule. After tax contributions, what Chris and I call cream, if they mix in to your 401k, what we are calling black coffee, if they're not accounted for separately, if they're just mixed in there, that cream is going to spread throughout the 401k, and you are not going to be able to cherry pick. You're making it sound like it's your option to include the earnings or not. First of all, it's not your option. It is your employer's option, and how do they account for everything? Generally speaking, the earnings on after-tax contributions are not accounted for separately.
Right.
And those, that's why if you want to really have no tax implications, you generally try to keep those contributions in a very low growth portfolio, if you will. So it's not going to generate a lot of earnings.
Or get it pulled out of there quickly so it doesn't have time.
Or get it pulled out quickly so you don't have time. Now, some employers only allow one in-service distribution a year. It's not like, oh, I'm going to put this money in and then the next day I'm taking it out. Mm-hmm. A lot of 401ks don't allow that. But you also have to find out how your 401k is keeping track of your after-tax contributions.
Right. I just thought of a great metaphor, a good adaptation to our cream in the coffee. We always talk about the cream being one of those little mini-moos that you pour in there. Some employers, when you put the after-tax cream in there, they open the mini-moo and they pour it in, and it's mixed together, and then obviously when it comes out, it has to come out pro rata. Some employers, though, drop the mini-moo in unopened.
Butterfingers.
What?
Butterfingers. If you were at a restaurant and a nurse,
I know what butterfingers
dropped, not
are.
A nurse. What the hell are they?
A nurse. At
not
the,
a nurse.
At
they're
diner?
Not nurses. What are they called? Waitresses.
Waitress, yes.
Thank you, nurse. And the waitress dropped a mini moo in your coffee. You would say butterfingers.
Okay, I'll go with that.
You never heard of butterfingers? Yeah,
no,
your hands
I
are
know
slippery.
What,
all
yes,
right. Well, I'm just saying.
Yes, butterfingers is very common.
All right, never mind. Keep going.
It's no problem. But the point is, if it's closed, you can easily dip in there and grab it out separately. The cream hasn't mixed in. Some employers handle it that way. That's the problem with a lot. That's why you need to investigate this and get clarity on how they account for all of this. As long as they don't open the mini-moo and pour it in, no problem. You can reach in and grab that mini-moo, roll it out, as long as you follow all the other rules and you're not violating the once per year in-service distribution and all these other things that could prevent you from pulling this off exactly the way you're describing. Yes, you can keep it. But if it mixes in, now you have trouble. You need to verify that, see what your employer's handling it. He's talking about it like they don't open the mini-moo. he's discussing it, saying he can access it separately and he can pluck it out with or without the earnings. It sounds like he's got at least enough information to be under the understanding that the Minimu hasn't been opened.
And exactly. And you got to do the same thing on the Rothpot folks and listener.
That's true. This is another good point. Glad you had it on the show today.
Thank you.
I know exactly where you're going with this. So
the earnings continue. On the 19 and a half he's putting in. You can't just exclude those listener. I don't know of any 401ks that even on the Roth part are going to say, oh, and don't worry about it. You can take out just your contributions. In an IRA, your contributions come out first. There is no pro rata rule in a Roth IRA. In other words, as Chris's analogy, the Minimu is not opened. When you put money into your Roth IRA, you can take just that money. Your contributions can come out at any time for any reason, no taxes, no penalties, from a Roth IRA, but not a Roth 401k. Roth 401ks is subject to the pro rata rule. You cannot specify, I just want my contributions coming out. To the best of my knowledge, and I could be wrong, I have been wrong in the past, but to the best of my knowledge, Roth 401k contributions, and the little chipmunk is running in my head right now along its wheel trying to remember the Ed Slot classes I've been to. But I have this nagging little thing in the back of my head saying, wait a minute, Roth 401k contributions cannot be taken out that way like a Roth IRA. You would move your money into a Roth IRA, then you can do it. But inside a Roth 401k, it's all pro rata. So there are going to be some...
Yeah, but if he's rolling it over into the Roth IRA, is he going to run into problems with that?
That's going to be a conversion.
From Roth to Roth, though.
Oh, from Roth to Roth he's going. That's a good point.
So I think as long as there's... I don't think the earnings in the Roth, it's the earnings in the traditional that are a function of the after-tax contribution. Those earnings, and people mix this up all the time, they're wondering, well, what's the difference between an after-tax contribution in the traditional and a Roth? The treatment of the earnings. If it's in a Roth, the earnings are also tax-free.
I'm going to go, though, Chris, that I don't know, listener.
There might be a gotcha. There might be a hidden gotcha in this one.
This is one that I'll probably run by Ed to get an idea on this, because there's something nagging in the back of my mind saying it's not going to be as easy as what he's thinking on that Roth side. And that's assuming, listener, your employer is actually tracking and allowing and will allow you to take your Roth contributions out as an in-service distribution. Mm-hmm. In-service distributions, again, are options. They don't have to be allowed, and they don't follow, well, they do have set rules, but different employers can have different rules on what right. they allow, what contributions are allowed to come out. Generally, their contributions, the match, never can come out in an in-service distribution. Is it only certain ones of yours? It may only be ones that are not subject to any vesting, usually. So what is your vesting schedule? Are you still on a vesting schedule, or is there no vesting schedule? And then, of course, the $8,500 that's going into your traditional IRA, are they tracking that separate?
401k, that's what he meant.
401k, not IRA. So I'm agreeing with the websites that are telling you these megas are not as easy as you're making it out to sound. And that's why they're all warning you to make sure you get good tax advice. Now, the unfortunate thing is you go to, you come to us and have Bob, our CPA, talk to you. Or if you go to your own CPA and talk to them, they're going to tell you exactly what I'm going to tell you. They have no idea if it's going to work the way you think. You have to get these answers from your employer.
And a lot of the HR folks aren't going to know even what you're talking about when you ask them this, from my experience. So the challenge here, once you get the rules clarified, exactly how things are going to be treated, it does become pretty straightforward.
Yes.
So the actual mechanics of pulling it off are straightforward. The challenge, and what all these websites are alluding to and what you're getting from us too, the challenge is deciphering the specific rules and treatment of your plan. That's more the challenge than anything. Once we understand the rules, then it's easy to play the game.
And as Ed Slott always taught us in his course, if the employer does allow you access in an in-service withdrawal, as you're alluding to, listener, to the earnings or not, and just kind of allowing you pretty much to take out anything, then the pro rata rule applies to all assets you have access to. If you, in fact, have access to the earnings or access to employee matches, in other words, you've been on long enough where you're fully vested and all employee matches and the earnings associated with that, plus the earnings associated with your discretionary contributions, if you have access to everything, the pro rata rule applies. You can't just say, I'm taking the $8,500. The pro rata rule, where you are going to take a little bit of cream and a little bit of coffee, will apply to all assets you have access to. That's why the employees, and you see this a lot in tech companies, where their employees make way too much money to contribute to Roths, so they really design their 401ks to accommodate mega backdoor Roths. We've seen this with a few of our physician clients, Chris, with the hospitals they work at. They really have very good rules on their distributions of what they have access to and don't have access to, and how they track all the contributions so these megas will work. But if your employer is just like, hey, take it. We don't care. What do you want? Just tell us. We'll give it to you. If you have access to everything and no restrictions on certain elements, the growth, the employer contributions, the growth on those contributions, if they're not restricting it, then the pro rata rule applies. And you're not just going to be able to take out the $8,500. That's why Chris and I and all these websites you're going to is saying, well, wait a minute, this is not easy. I agree with you, listener. The steps are fairly straightforward. There are going to be a lot of administrative steps involved here and paperwork and making sure it gets done right. But I admit they are fairly straightforward. It's the mechanics of what's underneath, what's bubbling in that 401k that I don't quite know. And I'm not quite sure you know, and you're going to have to dig for it. And as Chris said, unfortunately, you would think going to HR, you would get all these answers, and you may not. The best thing is try to find people who have done this and ask them, what does your 1099 say? What are you being restricted to? Find out what someone who's actually doing it is experiencing. Try to get copies of those tax documents and take them to your tax person and say, hey, this is what someone else is experiencing. Do you think this strategy would work for me? So that's what the difficulty on this is. But remember, any money that you have access to is subject to the pro rata rule. And keep that in mind. You don't tell us how much money you have in your traditional your traditional 401k pot. You don't tell us what you have in that. But that's where that $8,500 is going. And if you have access to earnings and access to employee contributions and access to the earnings on those employee contributions, you got the pro rata rule. Your mini-moo has been opened, as Chris said.
Yeah, but the 19.5 that's going into Roth 401k might be a different story. This is, again, you got to figure out how they're treating each one of these little buckets, if they're actually keeping them in separate buckets or
and
not.
And you have access
and
to it or not.
And you have access to them separately or not. Those are the kind of rules that need to be clarified here with HR.
But I do know that there is no ordering rules like there are in the Roth IRA, when you're taking it out of the Roth 401k, and that earnings will come out pro rata. And would they consider? I think they would consider that a conversion. I don't know. I could be totally wrong on that. And maybe they're considering it a transfer of Roth to Roth, so any earnings on that 19.5 would move tax-free because it's going Roth to Roth. But my gut tells me something is wrong here. So I will ask that question to the Ed Slot Group and try to get an answer from them on that and mention it on a future show. But listener, these aren't as straightforward as what you're hoping, and they're not as easy as what you're making it sound. You've got to do your due diligence because all 401ks, we've said this before, have different rules on what they will allow, what they won't allow, what they're tracking, what they're not tracking, and a lot of it comes down to the technology of the company sponsoring the plan. Do they have the software to track all this or not? Some 401ks do, some 401ks don't. And they're not giving tax advice. They're just going to do whatever you say. You can't really call the 401k and start asking them these tax questions, and they're going to tell you, we ain't answering these. They're not going to put the liability out on themselves. They're going to say, look, do you want the money or not? You figure it all out. And it's just a matter of doing a little bit of homework before you pull the trigger on that. Okay. Yep. This next IRA question is really straightforward, but I don't think there's a right or wrong answer to it. I think it's going to be more of an opinion. It's going to be up to your beliefs and my beliefs on how we're going to answer. Okay?
Sounds good.
All right. You weren't saying anything. Couldn't hear you. Okay, Jim and Chris, I've been listening to your show for almost 2 years. This is another Georgette, by the way, from California. You and Chris are very generous with the information you provide your listeners. It's clear in your responses that you both care about giving answers that will actually help people. Earlier this year, you did your five-part series on your methodology and process. Using my own Excel spreadsheet, I created a spending plan for myself using the process that you laid out. My husband and I are already retired, and as long as he's alive, we have a total of $84,000 in guaranteed income between our pensions and Social Security. Mm-hmm. My husband is 81. I am 62. So there's a big age difference between the two of them there, 19 years. Mm-hmm. We have been married for 30 years, and so far, so good. But when my husband dies, I will have a shortfall in my guaranteed income. I'm guessing between the loss of Social Security and maybe some of the pension. Mm-hmm. My shortage is estimated to be $17,000 a year. My question is this. Should I buy a QLAC in my IRA now or wait until something happens to my husband before buying an annuity for the guaranteed income I feel I will need? Recently, you mentioned criteria for people to consider before buying a QLAC. And honestly, I meet nearly all of the criteria. So what are the important considerations for me to think about when trying to decide if I should buy a QLAC now or later? And I do have sufficient funds in my IRA to accomplish this. Okay, this really brings out the art part of financial planning more than the science part. Before I give my thoughts and Chris shares his and then we wrap up, let me explain for those who don't know what a QLAC is. QLAC stands for Qualified Longevity Annuity Contract, QLAC, QLAC. They are the only annuities ever created by the Department of Treasury. They were proposed in 2000 and it was either 8 or 10. I believe it was 2010 is when they were first proposed, based on the market blow-up in late 2008, early 2009. The Department of Treasury, along with the Obama administration, wanted to encourage people to take some money out of the risk of the markets and the risk of doing retirement planning on your own and pool it with millions of other people. And they figured the best way to do that is with annuities. But they realized their own laws on IRAs and 401ks prevented people from buying what is known as longevity annuities. Remember, the L in QLAC stands for longevity. A longevity annuity is insurance protection that you live a long time. And the annuity will begin paying you in the future if you're still alive. There's the longevity protection. People like longevity annuities in the sense, if you knew, well, if I live to age 80 or 83 or 85, you choose what age when you open a longevity annuity, what age you want to take the money. Now, you can turn it on later. You could turn it on later or earlier under certain rules. But you choose the age you want it to begin. In theory, Chris, if you knew, well, at a certain age, I get all this additional money coming on if I'm still alive, it takes a lot of the risk of retirement away and emotionally allows you to feel comfortable spending money earlier in retirement because you know you have this backstop. So that's the theory behind a longevity annuity. They're not used that much, though. Very few people purchase longevity annuities. The government ran into a problem. They wanted to encourage, Chris, people to buy longevity annuities because a lot of retirees lost their shirt during the 08 blow-up in the markets and really messed up a lot of retirements. But their own rules requiring money inside IRAs to be withdrawn at the time at age 70 and a half, today it's 72, but it prevented people from deferring all this money in a longevity annuity. The IRS says, no, you got to start taking money out at 70 and a half. Well, the idea is to defer the money for a long time inside the annuity and then take it out later if you're still alive. So they changed the laws, wrote rules, and a description of how they wanted the annuity to work, and they said to the private insurance industry, if you come up with annuities that have these criterias, we will allow it to be owned inside of an IRA and not be subject to required minimum distributions, or inside of a 401k and not be subject to required minimum distributions. That's as deep as I want to get into them, folks. There's rules on how much you can put in and buy. But I just wanted you to understand what a QLAC was. So this listener must have most of her money, Chris, in always taxable IRAs. And she knows she has to purchase, if she wants a deferred annuity, she has to buy it on a QLAC strategy because a non-QLAC deferred income annuity, which essentially is what a QLAC is. It's a deferred income annuity with special features that make it a QLAC. If she bought a regular deferred income annuity, she'd have to turn the income on as early as age 72, and it kind of defeats the purpose of a backstop if you're still alive in your 80s. Follow me so far?
Yep.
Perfect. So now she's asking, hey, I listened to your show on QLACs. I understand how they work. In my opinion, I should consider it. A lot of your five criteria apply to me, but should I buy it now or buy it later? Here's where I'm torn. Chris and I talk all the time that on any type of deferred annuity, it's an irrevocable decision. The younger you, the 62-year-old you listener, would have to be adamant that, let's just say, the 82-year-old you. Well, she also says when her husband dies is when she's going to need this $17,000. So that was another reason I'm hesitant to tell her to buy a QLAC. But let's pretend they're close in age. He's 61, she's 62, instead of him being 81. If that was the case, listeners, the 62-year-old woman has to be adamant that the 82-year-old woman, or somewhere in her 80s, is usually when deferred annuities turns on. that somewhere in her 80s, she is definitely going to, number one, have longevity, and number two, have an income need, and number three, be alive. And if you buy an annuity in your 60s, you're essentially saying, a deferred income annuity, that is what I want to do it for. Now, we have used QLEX in a case where clients may feel they might need the income in the future, but more importantly, earlier they want to reduce the amount of required minimum distribution they're being forced to take out, because that is one of the other advantages of a QLEC. It will reduce the required minimum distributions because the money you put into the QLEC is not subject to RMDs. So we have used QLECs in that situation where people are trying to get money into a QLEC so they don't have to take RMDs right away. It allows them to do a little more tax planning, little smaller required minimum distributions, so they might be able to do more conversions, things like that. But the big downside, Chris, is what? You have to be adamant you need it in the future.
Well, one thing, if she turns out not to need it, it's going to turn on. She's going to turn it on. It's going to show up as income coming out, which would be similar to RMDs coming out of the account as well. So it's not like if she doesn't need it, she's, quote, lost something. She's just locked up money in an annuity that she might otherwise not have needed to lock up inside of an annuity. That's the trade-off. That's the cost. It doesn't disappear unless you pass away, of course. And there's the issue there. Depends if she didn't share with us anything about beneficiaries or inheritance for kids or anything like that. There's a few missing elements to her story that makes us have to kind of waffle on recommending things. Not that we, you know her full financial situation anyway, but the things she should consider in addition to this is, what other resources does she have? Ultimately, where do the assets pass to once she passes away? Because this will either increase the attractiveness of a QLAC or possibly decrease it. She kind of needs to make that pros and cons list, I guess, and look at it. And if, I think being 20 years older, it is very likely that he will predecease her. So even more than normal, I think the assumption that he's going to pass first is reasonable. So in her planning, the trouble is, it's a lot easier to recommend these or consider these if you have an income need in practically any scenario, whether two of you are alive or one of you, or, you know, either of you are alive. You can kind of say, well, no matter what happens, we don't know in what order this is all going to happen, who's going to pass first and all that. But in all cases, we need some extra income almost for sure in our 80s. That then makes a QLAC far more attractive than, you know, if this, if that, if all these boxes are checked, then I would like to have the QLAC. Then it's not quite as attractive. So you kind of have to make this pros and cons list of, am I willing to lock it up and possibly have it gone forever if I pass away and don't get a lot of the income coming back out of it, if I don't end up having longevity? Is that going to negatively affect people that I want to make sure to leave the money to? There might be other strategies or other approaches to this that might be more appropriate if there's some other factors that she has to include in all this. And actually, I think maybe, did she mention she has no kids on this, or am I thinking of something else? Did I mix a couple cases together?
I don't believe she mentioned.
Okay, so we don't know one way or the other, I think. It was another case I was thinking about with
yeah,
with
she doesn't
kids,
even mention.
Yeah, no mention of it. But that would be something kids. I would throw into the list of pros and cons.
I'm glad you mentioned the way you mentioned it, because personally, I'm against her using a QLEC here. And it's for one of the things you mentioned, but also another thing that you didn't mention. If, listener, you had a situation like Chris mentioned, where you crunched your numbers, and again, you did this all in an Excel spreadsheet. Nothing against Excel. We use much more sophisticated software. Let's just assume, though, we had done an analysis, or your Excel is really good, and you knew in your 80s And by then, your husband would be in his hundreds and most likely have predeceased you. But you personally, in your 80s, will have an income shortage, but only in your 80s. It's not now, and it's not in a year or two or three or four. It's in your 80s, and you're only in your early 60s. I would be receptive to a QLAC there if, irrespective of anything else, if this, then that, as Chris said, irrespective of anything else, if you knew without a doubt, no matter what happens, I am going to need this income in my 80s, and you wanted a sure thing. And there is nothing wrong with the younger you wanting to say, you know what? Yes, I know. I might be able to invest this money and interest rates might rise in the future and I might be able to eke out a little better return in the future if I don't buy the QLAC. That's how a lot of you do-it-yourselfers who are wicked into personal finance think of things. It's all the game. What's going to give me the most? And you're not paying attention to what's going to be the simplest, the easiest, and the safest. But if you want simple, easy, and safe, and which is what Chris and I tend to favor if you've been listening to this podcast for a while, simple, easy, safe, and you knew. It's not based on if this, then that. You simply knew in your 80s there was a shortage, and you're estimating the shortage to be $17,000. A QLAC could work for that because it's simple, it's safe, it's guaranteed. It is the younger you taking care of the older you. But here's my reason. She's not in that situation, Chris. She's saying when her husband passes away, there will be a $17,000 shortage. He could pass away tomorrow. We all could. I'm not degrading the situation that the man is 19 years older than her. You could pass away tomorrow. I could pass away tomorrow. I hope if one of us has to, it's you, not me. But, hey, that's just me personally.
Thanks for clarifying.
Hey, just want to point that out to the big man upstairs if he's picking straws.
I think that comment just pushed you down the list.
That pushed me down. It's going to be me. Okay. I hope it's not a plastic straw. Those aren't cool anymore. All righty. Here's my issue, Chris. She specifically said, when my husband passes away, I'm $17,000 short. Should I buy a QLAC to protect that? No, because QLACs don't work that way.
Right. She might need it much sooner. That's
exactly
a good point. I didn't get to the sooner aspect of it. But it's this kind of is part of that when I said you only need it if he passes and we have no idea when that's going to be. Early is really bad for trying to solve it with a QLAC.
The QLAC won't work.
The QLAC won't be
no
the
deferred
the fix
annuity
for that.
Is going to work.
Unless she doesn't, unless it's the combination, he's gone and she's in her 80s,
but
then
she didn't
it shows
say
up.
That.
She didn't say it like that, though.
She
I agree.
She said, when he's gone,
right.
I'm $17,000 in the hole. She didn't say, when he's gone and I'm in my 80s.
Yep.
So here's the problem, listener and listeners. When you buy a deferred income annuity, which is a QLAC, QLACs are deferred income annuities. You put money in today. You defer the income, and you tell the insurance company when you're deferring to. You have to look at the rules of each insurance company's QLAC, or deferred income annuity. Most make you stick to that age you tell them you're going to need the money. And there is your problem, listener. You don't know when your husband's going to pass away. Granted, he's 81. He may not live more than another 10, 15 years. He may live 10, 15 days. He may live 20 and hit 101. We don't know when you're going to need the money. QLACs must begin paying out at 85. So in your particular case, how old did she say she was?
She's, 61.
Okay, so in 13 years, they would have to pay out.
23 years.
23 years. I'm sorry, she's not 72.
62.
She's 62.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a long time in the future. But what if he died 23 days after you opened it? It's not going to give you one red cent. The most flexible QLAC that I know of right now is with New York Life. And I very rarely mention company names. But New York Life, their deferred annuity chassis, or at least it was when I last checked, which was last year. I don't represent New York Life, so they could have changed their rules. But they allowed their QLACs and their DIAs, deferred income annuities, to be turned on earlier. But you had to wait at least, I think it was 18 months or 13 months, I forget, after the last contribution, which in a QLAC would be the only contribution probably. So if your husband died 23 days after you opened it, you still wouldn't get anything out with that annuity until you hit, again, it was either 18 months or 23 months after the last contribution into the deferred income annuity or QLAC. But most annuities make you pick a date that you want the $17,000 to begin. Because in order for them to figure out how much you need to put in today to guarantee you $17,000 a year in the future, they got to know how long is this going to be percolating? How long are we, Mr. Insurance Company, going to have this money? How much are we going to earn on it? What is your chances of life expectancy after you tell us you need it? So they need to then figure out the mortality credits, and in order to do that, they need to know your age and the age you are going to be when you turn it on so they can figure out your remaining life expectancy and start factoring in the interest, the mortality credits, the principal. There's a lot of calculations happening behind the scenes, folks, that you don't see. So a QLAC won't work for you because you don't know when your husband's going to die and when you're going to need the $17,000. You just know when he dies, you will need $17,000. And deferred income annuities don't work that way. Now, it would work that way if your husband bought an annuity with an immediate annuity that's paying him with a joint and survivor payout. Actually, scratch that. I know where I'm going with that, but it's just going to confuse the hell out of you guys on this. Pretend I never even said that part. I want to try to keep this part simple. So it's not going to work for you trying to time when you're going to need the $17,000. Instead, I would recommend you put a reserve, if you will, aside, invest it conservatively. You don't have to take a whole heck of a lot of risk. And say to yourself, this is the money that I am going to use to purchase an annuity at the death of my husband, paying me $17,000 a year. How much do you put aside? Go to immediateannuities.com. And immediately tell them you need $17,000 a year. They will tell you how much you need to put into an annuity today for that. Because that's the worst case scenario, is it not, listener? Your husband could die today. So it would tell you how much to put aside today. Now, that annuity most likely would not have a cost of living increase. And you haven't shared any of that with us. What is that $17,000 a year increasing by? How much are you going to need? Because you may have to buy an annuity with a COLA adjustment, or you may have to ladder your annuity purchases, which is what Chris and I favor. You would purchase maybe a 10-year period certain annuity or a 15-year period certain annuity, paying you a little bit more than $17,000 a year, maybe $18,000, $19,000 a year, and then reserve enough money that when that period certain is gone, then you would begin another annuity. In other words, create your own inflationary protections. And if you died beforehand, you didn't put all that money into the annuity. You still have it reserved. So that's one strategy. It's just layering or laddering, rather.
Just to clarify that, too, you wouldn't have to do the period certain approach. You would do a non-COLA version and then pile it on top, kind of stack them. That's probably a more popular approach than a period certain. because you wouldn't want the annuity to just end. You don't get real great. You don't get much for mortality credits on a period certain. So I think.
No, I agree on that. The period certain would be cheaper than the lifetime.
Certainly, certainly.
If you told an insurance company, how much do I have to put in today for you to give me $17,000 a year, every year for the next 10, 12, 15 years, it's going to be a lot cheaper than saying the insurance company forever. So also what I was saying is probably look at both, Chris. The period certain and how much would you have to put in and how much is remaining in reserve outside of an annuity invested, maybe very conservatively, but still invested in a very good allocation fund. Vanguard has several that we like, Dodge & Cox, Mazen Powers. These all have good allocation style funds, nice and simple that you might use. And then when the period is over, if you have health and you have longevity, then you could put more money in, or you could do it Chris's way, where you're just going to buy a lifetime annuity at $17,000 and then purchase another annuity in 10, 12, 15 years to make up for the loss of purchasing power. Gee, $17,000 12 years from now, it's like I only am receiving $12,000 now. I need another five. Well, then you could buy an annuity in 10, 12 years that pays you $5,000 a year, and you would put a little bit more money into that one. So there's different ways of looking at it, but I fully agree with Chris. Look at both. Mm-hmm. I would look at both and see. But what I'm getting at, listener, you asked, should you consider a QLAC? The facts that you've laid out, no, I don't think you should consider a QLAC or a deferred income annuity at all, because of the restrictions on when you can get the money out. Most insurance companies, unlike the one company that I mentioned, New York Life, and this might have changed, but at the time, they were the only company that I knew of that would let you turn it on. Now, here's another thing, listeners. If she purchased, let's just say, at a company, and they're still going to ask, when do you want this money? And she sits there saying, well, you know, my husband, he's really healthy. I think he's going to make it to 95 at least. Okay, I want my money in 14 years. And then her husband dies 14 days or 14 weeks or 14 months into the 14-year percolating period. The insurance company, if it was the one that, in my case, New York Life, if that in fact still exists, and again, you had to wait either 13 months or 18 months, I forget. Let's say it was 13 and he died 14 months after. You're not going to get $17,000, listener. You're going to turn it on and they're going to factor it in. Okay, well, you were going to let it percolate for 14 years. You let it percolate for 14 months, you're going to get a very, very small amount. You can see what I'm getting at, Chris. Mm-hmm. They're going to say, wait a minute. You're turning this on. You're losing 13.8 years of percolation. So instead of getting 17,000, you may only get 8, 9, 10. They'll figure it out and tell you what you'll get, but they're not going to give you 17,000.
Right. The 17 is only if you wait the period.
Exactly, mm-hmm. Only if you wait. So that's why I don't feel the deferred income annuity works for you. It would be totally different if you knew exactly or approximately when you were going to need it in your 80s, and that need wasn't based on if this, then that. You have an if this, then that. If my husband dies, then I need the income.
Right. I'd throw out another option is that could include the QLAC. Have the QLAC for longevity protection for yourself, and the likelihood that by that time he will be gone, the high likelihood that he will be gone. But then protect between now and the QLAC turning on with reserved assets.
I like that.
That's kind of a blended approach where you still take advantage of the QLAC being in your IRA and getting the deferral and having the guaranteed income turn on as late as age 85, but then fill the gap, right? You've got the QLAC alone isn't going to protect everything, but there are ways, like I just mentioned, to have a combination of things that could fill the gap. Some people might be wondering, why aren't we talking about life insurance? Well, life insurance 81. For an 81-year-old is going to be really rough.
No, I was going to mention that, but the cost of life insurance, in other words, the life insurance strategy is, if there's going to be an income shortage, and I'm guessing it's his loss of Social Security and or pension, so you know at the death of one spouse, the other spouse is going to be hurting, and there's not enough assets to reserve to protect that spouse and allow the two of you to live comfortably enjoying yourself, then life insurance leverage definitely plays in. In other words, you take a little bit of your money and put it in a life insurance, and that will provide the protection. The reason I didn't mention it is, first, she said she had plenty of money in her IRA to buy this, but second of all, the age of her husband, the insurance would be so expensive, it wouldn't be worth doing. Right. Not at all. Because the amount of money she would need for $17,000 a year, if you're at your computer, Chris, under immediate annuities, what would she have to put in, a 62-year-old today, to get $17,000 a year for the rest of her life, no cost of living increase? While Chris figures that out, listeners, it's probably going to be a lot of money, relatively speaking. And if she has enough money for that, that gives her an idea of about how much she needs to reserve today. And when you reserve it, what we mean by that, it's just off limits for spending on fun. Remember, I said this on the last EDU show, retirement planning, when it comes to positioning your assets, is just asset liability mapping. She has a liability here. The liability is she's $17,000 short on secure income when her husband passes. So we have to match the assets now to that liability. And I would tell her to figure out what she needs to put in today. Worst case scenario, he dies tomorrow. What would it take today? And then squirrel that money out of your assets. Remember my cherry pie analogy. You're cutting a piece of cherry pie, a slice of cherry pie, and you're going to put that in the freezer. You're going to assign a reasonable allocation to it. I wouldn't go more than a conservative portfolio, maybe conservative growth, or what Morningstar calls moderately conservative, which would be about 65 stocks, 35% cash and bonds. I wouldn't go beyond that. Excuse me, the other way around.
Yeah, I was going to say, whoa.
65% cash and bonds. What was I thinking? 30 to 35% equities. And that money is squirreled away. It's sequestered. That pie slice is now assigned rather than using a QLAC. You could still use a QLAC for protection later and put another $125,000 or $130,000, which is the new limit on what you can put in, to put a backstop for the older you. What does it come to, Chris?
So for a 61-year-old female to generate $17,000 per year in a simple SPIA, about $340,000.
Okay, so that's how much you have to reserve, listener. Put $340,000 aside and enjoy your time with your husband. And manage it conservatively. And look at the bright side.
And as you age, that amount you're going to need is going to go down.
Exactly. So. Not only that, if interest rates go up, the amount you need goes down. If interest rates go down, the amount you need goes up. Interest rates are so damn low, I don't know how much lower they can go.
Right.
So chances are the $340,000 you're going to reserve is about all you're going to need initially. That QLAC, though, I mean, that SPIA, single premium immediate annuity, different type of annuity, she would put the $340,000 into the annuity when her husband dies, and the lost income, $17,000 a year that she's going to suffer at his death, would just begin
anew. Immediately. Right.
The one missing element is cost of living increase.
Yep.
If she was going to get one tied to COLA, CPI, that would probably be about three times what Chris just quoted you. It would be outrageously expensive. There's only one provider offering an annuity tied to CPI. There's a handful of annuities giving payment increases tied to a set percentage that you declare to them when you open it. Increase my payments 1%, 2%, 3%, 4%. The higher you go, the more money you got to put in the annuity. But that's less risky for the insurance company because they know ahead of time, okay, we've got to increase these payments 2% a year, 3% a year, 4% a year, and they can price it. When it's tied to CPI, Chris, insurance company doesn't know what.
They don't know what it's going to be every single year.
Exactly.
It's variable. So it's they have to build that volatility into all their projections, which becomes more expensive.
And there's only one company that is offering it to CPI. And if memory serves me correct, that one company stopped offering it. I've got to see if that is right or not. But only one company. Fortunately, it's an A-plus rated company. No, it's not New York Life. But it's an A-plus rated company. But only one company was left pricing them that way because it's so hard for them to figure out how to price it.
Well, we need to wrap up. So,
all right,
we've worn people out now with an hour and 26 minutes already.
Yeah, I know, but that was a good question. It's been a while since we talked about that. Hopefully, people can see the things to consider. It's not as straightforward as saying, "Oh, I'm going to need this." She didn't quite understand how QLEX worked. She understood QLEX. She didn't quite understand how the pricing and how you have to choose the year you want the income to begin. And unless she knows when her husband's going to die, it's not going to work, in my opinion.
Right. Well, perfect. There's another four questions down the pile. If you've got more Social Security questions, certainly send them in. I don't know how many Jim received.
Well, we got one more, but I didn't quite understand it. I got to give you. Very rarely do I let you see them ahead of time unless you come in here and steal them. but I am going to have you read this one because
It was a little confusing. No problem.
Like, huh?
So we'll tackle that one next week, most likely. We do want to thank everybody for listening. If you want to send in your own questions for the Q&A show, the way to do that would be to go to the website jimhelps.com. That's Jim, HELPS.com. On there, you can read a little bit more about what we do here and reach out to us with questions, submit a question for the Q&A show or a topic for our EDU show, which are more focused, more in-depth on one single topic kind of shows. But that's the best way to connect with us is right on that website, jimhelps.com. Those of you interested in doing retirement planning with us, we are looking at the light at the end of the tunnel as far as unpausing. We've got new resources in place to be able to handle more people who want to do those retirement plans that we talk about so frequently on the show here. And so stay tuned. News to come in the not too distant future, I'd say. Within the next couple of weeks, I should have more information. Not that we can accept a flood of people in 2 weeks, but at least more information on exactly how we can proceed from here.
And I do want to point out, because Bob does want us to mention, he's not paused like Chris. Bob, unlike Chris, can handle.
Yeah. Apparently, yeah.
No, Chris knows I'm teasing him. But Bob, a tax person, can handle a few tax plans. So if anybody is looking for advanced tax planning, Bob is still available, at least for the time being. I know he's going to get very busy towards the end of the year when he starts doing Roth conversion projections for people. But right now, the only part of our practice that is paused is the biggest part, which is 60-70% of people probably begin with a retirement plan. But tax planning, and for those who want it, even though we don't talk much about it, our investment management services, none of those have been paused. It is just our retirement planning that has been paused, yep. Which is like the main thing we do. But still, hopefully Chris will be able to unpause in the not too distant future.
Perfect. So thanks again, everybody, for listening, and we'll be back with you next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
Investors should consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of investment company products carefully before investing. The prospectus contains this and other information about the investment company. Prospectuses may be obtained from your advisor and should be read in full. All guarantees are backed by the claims-paying ability of the issuing insurer. Withdrawals and death benefits are subject to income tax. If withdrawals and other distributions are received prior to age 59 and a half, a 10% penalty may apply. Shares, when redeemed, may be worth more or less than the original cost.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.